Interview with Peter Kuhneman, 2nd of April, 1967.
If I may ask, did you get involved in the split between third and fourth internationals in that period, in England, sir?
There was no split in the third and fourth internationals. There was a third international, and in 1936, they still crossed the London International. Subsequently, after rolling around the world, he set up his so-called fourth international. There was a split here in the summer of 1940. In which some of the persons concerned used these arguments to prosecute. There was another split in the third and fourth.
Why did it take so long to come out of this ideological conflict? Can you call it that?
You know, I don't think really it's the common ideological conflict. So, the ideological conflict has nearly brought into the color, the perspective to other conflicts. You see, it's only going to start in 1930. That time it was largely a movement of certain section of the intelligentsia who were middle class or upper middle class, who had been abroad, come in contact with the family group abroad. They had given some sort of Soviet Union successes, particularly you remember the Soviet period of the world practice crisis, which was one country which didn't have unemployment and that tried to go into that. And when they came back, the worst part of the period in Ceylon, because we have the extremely difficult period in the rather down to about 1,000 pounds of 19, but the market collapsed. We have about a million pounds of people just flooded with the pieces when they were. And all the old leaderships were no longer giving good for the national leadership, but they are very good and active, and the very leadership is innocent. And then just prior to this, Guna Sinha had himself made contact with Randall John and gone over to the employer. So there was this sort of, they were looking for some sort of solution to that. And they had only been back to the station in Marxist America. And they came here, and the first attempt survey made by Dr. Richard Guna Sinha, who had started the whole thing here. That is what he talked to the doctor, he knows more about it than I do. I was at school. And then 5 years ago they started youth leagues and various organized youth trade unions. Of course they were left out because they were not in a single working class. So they were really lecturing, preaching and to themselves, having a little circle and so on. But they did manage to put over the idea of socialism up to about 1935. Then in 1935 they formed the Samajwadi Party. That was the first attempt to form a party with twin names, with National Independent Socialism. Because it wasn't a communist party, a Marxist party. It was a sort of broad, amorphous type party. All its terms from liberalism to communism were all mixed. Anyway, it was the first beginning. And from 1935 to 1940, they did very good work, I thought. They put over the ideas of socialism. They developed the anti-tubal struggle, the struggle against the Hickman system. They started the struggle for the use of the national languages. They started trade unions for the first time, and after the war collapsed, after the Muslim occurred. Then they ran up an international work of Spain. They had contacts with the international movement. Some of these visited Nehru came to the office and so on.
then where is the level of completion come? Would you say that by the early 30s, Gunasinghe had put on political hat and was a radical of yesterday?
Well, it's very early 30s, he still had a reflection on the working, undoubtedly. But he had ceased to be a fighter for the workers' cause. Whereas in the old days, Mr. Goran, in the 1920s, he went out with the slogan for workers of the world unite. In the 1930s, he was going around with the slogan of smoke, tea, and cigarettes. Even though he was president of the anti-smoking league, it was good. But then he got mixed up with various industrials, doctors, and others. He got more of those efforts. What do you want political practice for the musical day? You know, most of the practice, I don't know, nothing. In practice, he had ceased being a militant leader of open class. In 1940, the practice was developing inside the Kamsamaj party. There is between one section who wanted to have proper connection to working class, who wanted to have trade unions built up. And the other thing was, who didn't want to give such a specifically proletarian job. And this was made also more sharp because of the repression that was launched against the movement. Because, you know, at the time of the Soviet-Finnish War, there was a tremendous anti-Soviet campaign throughout the world. And this was the beginning of the Second World War. And in preparation for that, enormous repression was launched against the working class. People were arrested and so on and so forth. And all these factors made a certain section wanted to disassociate themselves from any support of the Soviet Union, any support of socialism. And of course, it's much more respectable to do it with some big theory rather than some of the things that are going to be top theory. That's why out of the blue, something that had been dead and buried in 1936, it was resurrected here. But essentially, why did they select this and nothing else? The reason was that, social democracy as such was distinct here. It had become very much part of the imperialist apparatus. The two labor governments had really carried on with this imperialism and continued to shoot down workers, press them, and so on, to keep down the national movements. So, social democracy was not appropriate, it was kind of discredited. And Trotsky's ideas, to some extent, appealed to the middle class, because they reflected two aspects of it. One is the anti-capitalist aspect, because you're in the middle of the ladder, and you dislike the fellow higher up who's keeping your head. You want to push him off. So that way you've got a lot of verbal stuff against him. But also there are another level of fellows who are going to put the whole damn ladder down. Well, dominant, and they don't like it because you want to go up to the top of the ladder. So you become anti-communist at the same time. And this is how this is the real social base, like the of why this was selected as a particular one. Of course, there were honest people also who were confused by it. I mean, they didn't know. I realized that socialism, building socialism, is a very complex problem. Fighting for socialism, even carrying on a revolution. The movement is a very complex, but it's not a kind of thing that's guided inside of their books.
Mm-hmm. You referred to this earlier division between those who wanted a proletarian base and those who wanted to go out and get a...
They wanted to keep it on a... Still, as a broad national slogan, so not the people. Immediate, direct contact with working class.
When you refer to working class, are you including the peasant?
No, I'm not. I'm including industrial workers. Mm-hmm. Industrial and plantation workers.
And then
it has always been the weakness of the left movement here, is that there has not been sufficiently close to the peasant.
How would you explain that?
I'd explain it due to certain, in my opinion, certain theoretical effects of the left. That they didn't understand the need for broad work among peasant. And of course, particularly those who had accepted the Trotsky movement, inherited Trotsky's personal view that the peasant is a reaction to the class and that the working class must come in collision with the peasant. That was one of Trotsky's theories. Well, it's not a theory that we're doing, that the Marxist Leninist have accepted, because their theory was that it was supposed to be an ally of the working class. But nevertheless, it's kind of the need in this situation. And of course, the other reason is that the way in which the working class movement and revolutionary movement developed out of towns. The peasants don't live in the towns, they live outside the towns. And also, to a great extent, I think the working class leaders of that time had a discomfort of living in the village.
Yes, so would, in explanation, wouldn't you say that the leaders themselves were purposed or by choice urbanized, far too urbanized?
It was inevitable. This is a historical development we find everywhere. You see, in countries which were former colonial countries, or at this particular time were in fact colonial countries, literacy and education were the monopoly of only a small group of people. The vast mass of workers did not have education. It was a long change, but they changed after this period. They changed in the 1940s and 50s. And today we are getting the benefit of that change. But at that time, we only knew a lot of literate persons. Persons who could, not merely read and write and sign their names, but able of broader, wider comprehension, came from this place. So it is naturally that they shut up.
Now this section who were demanding a broader sort of national front.
No, they were not national front, by
no. National slogans.
No, they were more, they were concerned more with some biting of injustices, color discrimination and
equality.
The white people didn't treat the black people nicely, that should be stopped and over the nationalist slogans like weight of money collected on armistice day was given to European soldiers, was given to our soldiers, for nationalist slogans.
No, would you include the Trotskyites within that wing?
Actually, there are really Trotskyites in Ceylon. They never were real Trotskyites. This is a really invention of the place which is not the people thought. There were a few people who were Trotskyites in the sense that they followed Trotsky's teachings, but the rest were. Well, a whole lot of middle class forms of socialism.
Who would you class as the ones who are real Trotskyites?
No comments on this, please. I'm not going to name names.
And if I may ask you something personal, had you...
Well, now we said it's so much party itself is now split, you see, of that Trotsky's group. The Trotsky's group has formed a separate party. But of course, some of the great Trotskys of those days are now the great leaders of reaction in Ceylon, including Mr. Edmund Dickinson. I might mention those events. They took anti-communism to its radical conclusion. They became the real spokesman of the big voters.
I'm trying to follow that logical conclusion.
Well, if you want to fight communism, the most effective class and force fighting communism is the big bourgeoisie. So why have side fights? Why not go and become a general in the main army? That's what they do. Exactly what they do.
Did you have...
See, to some extent, also this Trotsky's idea was encouraged by the British colonial office. So that I know, I was in Britain at that time.
Yes.
And they were very worried about the development of the last summer Samaj movement. They saw it, and quite correctly saw it, as the beginning of a threat to the British position. And they were very anxious and to have a split, and a general split. So in practice they encouraged the students, a section of the students who were in London at that time, to make contact with certain African Trotskyists, who have ceased, most of whom have ceased to be Trotskyists now. Some of them have become actual leaders of their countries, so I'm not mentioning them, I know them. And this was that group, which was really as a result of certain encouragement of the colonial office, which helped to spread this particular thing.
How
the world people in Ceylon had never heard of it before.
How did they encourage the group? I mean, wouldn't the student...
I'll give an example. One of the people who brought us this idea is a man called Vernon Gunasekhar. And he was the nephew of Saharad Gunasekhar. I think a lawyer of some type. He spent most of his time writing vitriolic pamphlets. He had a great capacity for abuse in English. Really, quite gifted in abuse. And in polemical abuse, one of the most gifted men we've had. And this was his sole contribution to his to write anonymous leaflets against people and publish them, distribute them and others. He spent most of his time reading them. And he was very anxious to get support for the election. And he went to England and discussed various people and said this.
Support for whom?
Well, ostensibly for the Samajwadi Party. But I don't think he was authorized. And he went on asking various people to give him money and contributions and so on. And then they said, well, if you're so strong, why the hell do you have to come to England to get money? You've got to get money in your own country. So he was very bitterly annoyed about the sort of thing. And then he was one of the fellows who had me. Well, maintaining this context, I was referring to him.
With the colonel?
I don't know. I can't say whether he maintained connection with the colonel office. But I know the colonel office is to raise this, but he certainly maintained connection with the other people, that, with African trustees that I was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
That is one form. But that's not the only reason, isn't it? It was a philosophy that was raked out of the political, old storage and used because this was perfectly appropriate.
Did the way in which the British colonial office and others worked include the sort of reputed hiring of a well-known university lecturer to split the ranks of the system as a theory could follow? Seems far-fetched.
I understand the theory, but I don't know. I don't think so.
It seems far-fetched to me.
I wouldn't say far-fetched. I've had quite a few experiences of how the colonial bureaucracies to work. The idea that they should hire people to inform or to act as I don't know what the case is not at all supposed. But in this particular case,
yes.
I don't think so.
Now, I was saying it's far-fetched simply on the basis of the personality of concern, you see.
But the trouble is that if you want to be successful as a doctor, you must also do a lot of constructive work. Otherwise, no one will pay any attention to you.
Mm-hmm.
In the history of the Soviet Communist Party, there was a man called Malinovsky, I can't remember his name right, but I can't remember now. And of course, he was an agent of the Cheka. He was for years an agent of the Cheka. And he was a member of the Central Committee. And of course, he played a very big part in the revolution, including carrying out the revolution. And if he didn't do that, he couldn't be a useful agent for the Cheka. So I think Lenin in some ways speaks about this matter.
Agent for the
Cheka, the secret police of the Russians, Tsar at the time. Well, we didn't have the same unfortunate experiences in our party, but certainly in the Genesis speak of it. Desmond Wickramasinghe, probably one of the main agents I want to do in the sense of a paid agent, a voluntary agent of imperialist positions internationally and locally. He was sitting in the Central Committee and Political Bureau for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Regarding your own ideas, did you develop your, say, your radicalism and your socialism here, or was it more at the English level?
It started here. But at that time there was no left movement at all. I left England about a few days after the Samajwadi Party was formed, formation. I attended them at that time. But it struck me that it was a very odious one. Of course, I was very much a snooty young man. My first contact with politics was made by reading Denny, which was in my father's, I found it in my father's library.
Lenin.
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 And yeah, Rick Friedman asked for whether there are any other books by Lenin. I read a fair amount about Lenin. Generally, you know, it was intellectual witness to me. Because there was no movement. And whatever movement there was, I was isolated from, because to start with, it was missing. The reason I didn't know anything aware of civilians at that time. And I came myself from the upper class. And so it was all sort of in the air, in the theory. So when I went to Britain and university, I remember there was at my college university, there was some communist club or something, and I went. And then I asked people where I could join. And then they sort of sent my theater before the committee and vexed people. And they asked me, have you read the Daily Welfare? And I said, no, I'm just quite frankly, I never heard of the Daily Welfare. And various questions in relation to British communist policies, I didn't know a thing about. I was hearing about something in the Communist International, which was like 35 minutes. I didn't know much about it. I knew about Spain, but it was all. Then they asked me, what have I done? And I said, Lenin. And nobody believed this. And they thought I was some sort of an agent. Then they asked me a lot of questions, and they discovered that I had been very tricky. So after that, I had to sort of learn and practice about a movement. So it really started here, but developed.
There always seemed to have been a period there in England when the leftist movement of radicalism and socialism grew. And if I recall rightly, now Maclean, Burgess, they all had their background then, as I said.
The same things happened today in America. You see, it's particularly, this was a period of great ferment among the youth and among the intellectuals. There are two reasons for this. One is, the first one is about the fascism, which openly was anti-intellectual. Struck down all the values that the intellectuals, to enforce the intellectuals said. An advanced section of the intelligentsia rebelled against this, and it was only the communists who were fighting against the badges. Second question, it was completely clear that there was a war coming. Mm-hmm. And it was only the communists who were trying to stop a war. And mind you, most of the people in universities and others were the people who were going to do the fighting. They were going to be the people who had to, the war came, they would be in the front rank.
Officers?
Well, either officers. It was not at all surprising that the young people should be the first to be voted. And that's happening in the United States today.
Because of Vietnam.
Well, whatever. There are people who are going to be sent away.
There appears to be a far greater education on Vietnam among people at universities and high schools and so on than there is among the trade union movement. Which is a sad thing, but it seems to be so. It's a sort of Popeye development in the United States, but it's definitely taking place.
This split in the Marxist ranks in Ceylon, was it accentuated by the splits in the course of the history by personal factors, a clash of personalities? Say.
You see, the Communist Party, we never had a split. We only had only one split. That was 2 years ago. A small group of people who I think were basically motivated by personal and other factors tried to take up some of the wrong ideas of the Chinese as their weapons. Very often you have you want the split for some one reason, and after you have the split, you have to take some big ideological question. So it's difficult for me to answer that, because I was never a member of the RSSP. The RSSP is the party that has the biggest number of splits.
I know.
So you really have to ask some of them about it.
No, but as a sort of, shall I say, interested and more knowledgeable outsider, say, than one of the bourgeois, the UNP members, I was wondering if you had any inside knowledge on that.
When it comes to splitting an organization, I don't think you can ever say that it's purely done from personal subjective reasons. Mm-hmm. Because if it was done like that, it would seem to be a very serious split. And some of the splits were serious. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it is. You see, when you adopt wrong policies and you try to put them into practice, well, sooner or later they have to work themselves out. you were faced with the reality of your policy, then you've got to take a decision how to either to drop it, to amend it, or to carry it forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the early 30s, later on, have you read Mao's works too?
Yes,
mm-hmm. I have
read those that are in English.
Mm-hmm. I noticed you mentioned these wrong ideas. In what sense do you consider them wrong?
By way of a long speech, because they keep on bringing up new and new wrong ideas. Basically, it's not only a question of ideas, it's a question of policy. You see, when somebody has a wrong idea, it doesn't matter, but when it comes to policy, when a movement, the party, the country, it has to carry that out, then it becomes a serious objective matter in the world affairs. So what are they doing? They're expressing quite wrong ideas. First, they think that the main competition in the world is the competition between the what they call the National Liberation Movement and imperialism. But that's not true. The main competition is socialism and imperialism. Secondary competition, which helps socialism require, is the National Liberation Movement. Because even if the National Liberation Movement is successful, it doesn't mean that capitalism is abolished. I mean, most of the countries have got national independence, which are still all capitalist, or in the capitalist world system. So that by itself is not a good step forward. It's a good thing, but we need not think it's a fundamental solution. Then there's an old element of racialism, and there's an element of great power, capitalism. That it doesn't matter that they were thousands and half the world is wiped out, the glorious future is built up the ruins. An anti-human thing completely opposed to what they were
doing. But then wasn't there this feature also noticeable in Russia under Stalin?
Yes. Under no circumstances. Stalin made mistakes. Stalin's mistakes were basically the mistakes of not being able to distinguish between gentlemen. And the result of that made a lot of wrong, and it was wrong for a lot of us. So basically, when it came to fighting in the interior, it worked quite well. What it was doing. So it made tactical mistakes and it was a push. But we never had this idea that by blowing up the world, we can get a new world. Or the idea of Mao Zedong, that the present is the main force of revolution, not in the working class, the secondary force. Or that there is only one form of advance to socialism today, and that is revolution, which is, let's say, armed struggle, armed civil war, armed struggle. Well, you armed in certain countries, you must have armed struggle. There's no other way. In certain countries, it might be possible not to have it. The question has to be solved about which way is appropriate in a particular country. Naturally, we'd all prefer to do it without armed struggle. It is something very costly and difficult. But of course, it doesn't depend not only on us, it depends on the bourgeoisie as well. If they provoke our struggle, then it would be good if not to take note of it.
But, schism here, you think that the people have... how would you explain the attraction to this Chinese line?
It's a form of the national arrogance of the political system. You know, they like it because it keeps the working class down. It puts the present which is a very base, social base of the petty bourgeoisie up. It puts this wrong idea that the real struggle in the world is to be rich nations and poor nations, or white nations and black and yellow nations, or some nonsense like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what corresponds to a certain middle class. Some people think that the entire national liberation struggle is fighting against the right to go to the Colombo swimming club, which didn't admit colored people. It is a very big, important matter to people who enjoy every other right. It's a problem for the swimming club. But the ordinary man, he can't get even into the SSC or the Tamil union, so what are we going to do? So the swimming club admits him out. He has no chance of getting in there except for the surf.
Do you think that this Chinese line appeals to a, shall I say, a national chauvinism inherent in this group.
It appears to a certain national chauvinism of the petty bourgeoisie. The second thing it appears to is politically inexperienced. When Lenin said about Trotsky that he always battled the schoolboys, it's a new Trotsky's life. It really does the more diverse, the lovely and very catchy. As long as you don't have to do anything about it. It's wonderful. Revolution, storming the barricades, and all that.
It's all adventure stories.
No, I mean, it has to be done, but when it's been done, I don't know, see, these people talk so much about revolution. they sit around in the coffee shops with me. We come to an honorary clash with the police in a strike. I haven't seen the revolution boys around here. Okay.
Going back to the 40s, I noticed that your party took the name United Socialist Party at the start. Was there any significance in terms of...
Yes. Our party really arose out of the script in some of the North Park in 1940. At that time, all the people who had stood together, the year may be dispelled, they got together to start with this form of the one workers' circle. Because I believe it was an amorphous party altogether, and even in the split, there were certain amorphous features about the split. Because some people were attracted, you know, had loyalty to local personalities and so on. So we started having study classes and Marxist education and organizing the trade unions and so on and so forth. But we didn't feel that the time had matured for the formation yet of a communist party on Marxist and Leninism. So after a little time, anyway, we thought we must have some political formation. We had only a trade union formation at that time and what a whole workers' study circuit. So we started what we called the United Socialist Party, but it wasn't a strict Marxist-Leninist party. And after 2 or 3 years, the reason was that there were various other little groups here. There was a group of people who hadn't been in the LSSP, but who called themselves the Ceylon Socialist Party, various other little groups. So all of these got together and we formed what was called the United Socialist Party, which was broadly following what was correct in the old policy of the LSSP, which was very close to the policy of Marxist-Leninist parties, but which was not completely orientated as a Marxist-Leninist party. When we went on, we got banned in 1941, I think we wanted to get that illegal, we had to go underground. And while we were underground, the discussions went on, and the processes of clarification and policy making went on. And of course, there was the day-to-day struggle went on too, which helped us more than even all the arguments. And by 1963, we were in a position to say that we could form a communist party. And at that stage...
You were not illegal then?
We were illegal. We were illegal. Actually, it was formed here. This all is broken down now. There was a house here, from that point. It's broken down now. These houses are here. I think it was formed here. And we were there also. I'm not sure we were in that house at one time, in this house. And now I've found the house is over there. It's all this here. The area of the communist had hit me for a long time. And then we felt that the situation had gotten mature sufficiently, and then we had a Congress was held there, an underground Congress, and took the decision to change the name of the Constitution to Congress. And Constitution is a strong Congress party.
But weren't you in favor of the law effort and support given by Sennac and others to...
We were in favor of the support of the war effort against fascism. We were very critical of the role of Ceylon and Tenanis because we didn't think the way to pursue the war effort was just toting to the British. In fact, the British weren't interested in getting allowing the Ceylonians to develop any sort of struggle against fascism. Because that was developed, the independence movement also developed.
But don't you think that by cooperating, they got independence quicker and on largely their terms?
I don't think. I think the nearest we could come to getting independence was in 1956. In 1948, we had a sort of deal struck by Serenac or one man, representing the sort of national group, the sort of Commodore group of forces, and the British.
Yes, sir.
In which, you know, certain powers were transferred.
I agree that there was a Comprador element, but the fact is that that paved the way for 56, and apart from that, when you look at the powers which the Srinivas were given, they had virtually everything in their hands, in the sense that while the banks and others, and while there was financial capitalism and imperialism, they had the political power to remove, as was shown by the nationalization.
No, as we showed, no, you see, start with, there was the defense agreement which the British forces, bases were here. But remember, the bases were got rid of only in 57. That was really a practical limitation, because as long as foreign troops are on your soil, it becomes a very serious potential threat to it, your independence.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the subsequently showed that the constitution, which incidentally was never accepted by Ceylon, but was imposed on Ceylon by a bodily council, cannot be changed in fundamentally. The Privy Council judgments, and now the latest judgment in India on their fundamental rights question, shows that the general tendency as far as the British are concerned is to regard our position as, in certain matters, as built in and cannot be changed. The fundamental structure of the Constitution can't be changed.
Isn't there a provision for constitutional amendments?
It's not on fundamental questions. For instance, take Article 29. The Article 29 is the article which gives is really the basis of the Constitution, which gives Parliament the power to make laws. But proceeds to restrict those. No, that's not a good thing, because Parliament should be completely sovereign, and the only guaranteed rights of minorities are guaranteed by fundamental rights, not by restricting the rights of Parliament. Now, there have been cases in which decisions have been made by the Privy Council that you can't amend Article 29, even if the entire Parliament is in favor, not only two-thirds in favor, it's a whole lot in favor, it can't be amended. Secondly, the structure of the Constitution, the separation of powers, that can't be amended. So these are really the basic questions. You can amend the minor questions of the Constitution. In the case of the nationalization, you need a constitution amendment.
No, that, what I meant is that for the age, I mean...
No, nothing to the legal age, there was nothing to stop the old state council nationalizing the banks. Except that any one part of the state council that could be approved by the governor too. But apart from that, there was no law that stopped them doing it.
So in the sense that they removed the government's powers and gave powers to the parliament here, meant that they could undermine the economic foundations, they had the economic foundations of the capitalists.
Well, they expected, what they, one thing they never bargained for was the shame of the citizens. I mean, they had bargained with certain constitutional amendments. So they, you see, after all, one of the reasons for the deal that was done between Serenata and Gunapet on this side and the division right there, was that there could be a class in power which, on these fundamental questions, would carry on in the old way. They didn't expect Bandar Nayak to they thought that the only opposition they will have is the left opposition. And that it will, if the left opposition is there, well, it doesn't matter what they come to power, we are finished anyway.
It is said that the fact that the LSSP were against the war effort helped the Communist Party in the sense that there was some competition for union leadership, and because most of them were in jail, you were able to develop your unions at a faster rate.
I don't think this is correct. At that time, there was a lot of cockeyed ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That the revolution in Ceylon was really decided by the revolution in India. And because there weren't any people to carry out the revolution in India, they decided to take the rules to transfer themselves to India.
That's the Bolshevik-Lenin group.
Well, they were all so called Bolshevik-Lenin group.
But Philip didn't...
Even Philip at that time. They went to India. Some of them... Well, not everybody was in prison. Some of them escaped then. Some of them went to India. On this case, well, this was the main source of the Ceylonese revolution. And that they didn't do anything with them.
Yeah, but for a period, some were in jail. And they had only a rump organization, or not, without the top men.
But we were in jail, we were both in jail at the same time.
Yes, but they were in jail. They escaped in foreign.
They escaped rather than the students here. It was in Mendes and others were foreign here. Because they had not been detained, because they were sent here under four offenses against the war, but then they were originated the war.
Oh, Mendes wasn't there, was it?
The prisoner was in
Mendes. Throughout the war?
No. He was released after 2 years. Dr. Richardson was in jail, and Reverend Sarnand was died in jail, and he was killed at that time.
But is it correct to say that throughout there have been rival unions, one led by your party and others led by the various Samtamaj groups?
Well, in the private sector, we have a lot of unions led by a lot of people, because the law is that 27 people can form a trade union. So, it's a thing. Any person form a union and the government recognizes it, provided it's got 7 people. That is the purpose of the law. That is not so in the case of the public sector. In the public sector, unions aren't affiliated. So therefore, the tendency there has been for all the workers to join one union, or the most two.
But don't you think that from the socialist point of view, this split in as far as unions are concerned, the split in the proletarian ranks has retarded the movement, the rhythm of the movement.
Yes, yes. Of course, it's a rhythm of a certain amount of unity. There is, in the first joint committee of trade unions, the most of the major important trade unions are. Alasamaj unions are there, our unions are there, Srinathar unions are there, independent unions are there.
How is the cooperation at the moment?
Very good.
Now in 47,
yes.
Your party is said to have given tentative support to the UNP, is that correct?
It's all based on the decision that was taken at one of our conferences.
Uh-huh.
It was a politically wrong decision, there's no doubt about it. At that time, it was before 47, it was in 45 or 46, before the election.
Uh-huh.
45 I mean, so that at the time, you see, there was all the forces were in one party. In fact, there was no UNP at that time. There was Congress, Singhala Mahasabha, and Chennaika Sabha, and so on. So Ramamurthy, he had a block with the Congress people. And then, anticipating the election, of course, there was a split. There the Congress and the Singhala Mahasabha and all these people got together and formed the UNP. Now as we had in relation with the Congress, there was a big discussion in the party about whether we should tactically fight a whole lot of them together, or whether we should try to separate Congress elements who had gone over from the old BSN national elements. And there was a big discussion at that time, and by one vote,
this was at the big oil party conference.
At the conference. At that time, I went to the party of 200 members. The meeting was alone in that house, so I know.
One,
I had 200 delegates. You know,
200 delegates, but surely the party.
No, no, membership was more, but 200 delegates.
How many members did you have at that stage? Roughly, I'm very.
5,000. I can't remember the record, And just by one vote, it was passed. Then subsequently, about 2 months later, before anything happened, then the matter, there was another discussion in the Central Committee, and I think another special conference was convened, which revoked.
And following the line taken by the Central Committee?
Yes. That was revoked. So all this talk is based on that decision. But in practice, it never got implemented.
Now that decision, I presume, must have been publicized then.
Oh, yes. Oh, we published all that decision. It was a conference or something like that. There's a little pamphlet I wrote on the history of the party.
I haven't got that. I've seen that ever since the thing, but...
Oh, and 2 years ago, a copy of that, 20 years of the Communist Party. I
And what do you think of the party's role in the 45, 46, 47 strikes?
Do you think we were the people who needed to have the worst after that strike?
Yes, first strike.
The first strike. And right through, we participated in all of them. And what's most important, the members, the general strike of 47.
Surekha Union joined that?
That's the first time that we had the white collar workers coming to the strike. And actually, the importance of the strike was political, because it was the result of the strike that the British realized that they couldn't move in the old way. And Senna utilized that situation. It was the one that to come to the deal on 47, 48.
Let us deal with the matter.
If you don't give me what I want and come to serve with me, these people are going to take over the Senna.